Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 42.
42.
Oh, can you believe it? I can't believe it. And today I'm joined, as you're hearing, by Walter Brogan, who's professor of philosophy at Villanova University and editor of Epoche, the Journal for the History of Philosophy, and a founding member of the Ancient Philosophy Society, for which I am and many of us are very grateful. Walter is the author of numerous publications on ancient philosophy, hermeneutics, and contemporary continental philosophy, and his most recent book is Heidegger and Aristotle, The Twofoldness of Being, published by SUNY Press in 2005, which is essential reading for anyone who is interested in Heideggerian engagement with Aristotle. But today he joins me here in Montreal, Canada, where we're at the 49th annual SPEP meeting. And he's here to discuss an essay entitled In the Wake of Socrates' Impossible Memory, in which he focuses on the problem of remembrance in the dialogues and specifically the complex dynamics associated with Plato's attempts to remember the life of Socrates. So, Walter, it's really great. Thank you for coming on the Digital Dialogue.
Well, thank you, Chris. This is exciting. It's different for me. So I'm looking forward to talking.
Yes, that's the thing that I've found so great and interesting about just turning a microphone on, and it does add a different kind of dimension because we don't get a chance. We get the chance to talk to each other in at conferences, after talks, or in responses to papers and things.
We're so used to also reading and to having the what feels like at least the confidence of the script.
Right.
And so this is really, I think, a great idea to see if we can experiment with what it's like to be outside of that.
Right. You know.
Well, as you mentioned, I have a paper now. I'm wishing I had my paper.
Right, exactly. No, well, I mean, it brings the one of the themes of your paper is writing versus the sort of oral tradition that Socrates embraces, and then this interesting tension at the beginning of the Phaedo where we find Socrates writing, and so actually maybe we could start there talking about the difference between writing and Socrates's. At least for most of his life, insistent that he's not going to write, that he'll just engage in dialogue.
Yeah. So there's, I think, a couple of interesting issues there. The first is maybe the easiest to mention, which is the resistance of Socrates or Plato to writing as somehow effacing the dialogical character of philosophy.
Right.
But also writing as establishing a kind of belief that you can somehow preserve and record or keep a record of authentic philosophical life.
Right.
And it seems to be on the part of Socrates, as we all know, a certain resistance to that. Mm-hmm. And the question would be, what is that resistance? And what does it have to say about the question of memory,
which
is so fundamental? So writing seems to have something to do with the belief that we can cure the impossibility of memory in a certain sense, and yet the holding open of the promise of memory, and that writing, minimally we can say, says something about that, and perhaps potentially can destroy a notion of memory that I think was very important to Plato and Socrates.
Right. So, I mean, you make reference at the beginning of the essay to the Phaedrus where there is this exchange about writing and Socrates. Well, in the context of a discussion between Thamus and Tois, where the argument that Thamus, who's created this wonderful thing called writing, makes is, "Well, look at this great thing I'm giving you," and the Egyptian king is saying, "Well, wait a minute. You really, what you're doing is." Reducing people's ability to remember because they'll just write it down. So that one thing, you're reducing people's ability to remember, and the other thing is you're allowing these writings to go in the hands of people who might not know what to do with them.
Yes, exactly. Right.
So I wonder what, I mean, so maybe we could talk a little bit about Plato's decision to write in the face of what happens in the Phaedo, namely the death of Socrates. I mean, what's in the essay, maybe you should talk a little bit about the strategy of the essay, but then the essay is really dealing with the question of memory and philosophy as a form of remembrance.
Right. And of course, therefore, I mean, the theater becomes very important because the context of the dialogue is the impending death of Socrates. In other words, the loss of the authentic voice, the loss right. of the immediate contact, if you will. You know, it's almost a Kierkegaardian theme,
yeah.
but the loss of the immediate presence of the other.
Right.
And so the initial question of writing is really a question about whether we can preserve philosophy from loss,
right.
or whether philosophy is always in the face of the loss of Socrates, the death of the father, and then the question of whether philosophy can ever recover this desire for the connection with the with the father or the oneness, or whether the alternative possibility that I was exploring is whether philosophy always occurs in the face of this loss,
right.
And therefore an impossible memory, but nevertheless that's precisely what memory is, mm-hmm. is this search for the origin,
right.
for the lost origin, and that's very complicated when I say
yeah
that.
Right, exactly. So I mean, I want, maybe we could parse it out a little bit, because so there's okay, let's start with this idea of a recognition of lack, a recognition of, I mean, and which really animates Socrates' whole life, right? This knowledge, the thing he knows is that he doesn't know. The thing he knows is this lack of a certain kind of wisdom that people think is possible. I wonder whether he himself thinks it's possible, or just recognizing it as a lack is vitally important, because it's what drives you for, it's what animates philosophy. And so I guess the question, so the thing, let me ask it this way. We have on one hand the loss of Socrates and that human encounter between Plato and Socrates. On the other hand, the larger issue of human finitude and what and how to respond in a way that is, I think, philosophically rich to this fundamental human lack.
Yep.
So how do you see those two belonging together? The person, this human relationship, and then this bigger excessive human condition question.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the dialogue is very much about the temptation to read this relationship to an impossible origin,
mm-hmm.
or an origin that is always irremediably past, so in a right. time before time,
right, right,
irrecuperable, uncapturable, but nevertheless mm-hmm. a loss to which we are in relationship if we are philosophers.
Right,
it's tempting to think that this demand of philosophy to stay in touch with this impossible origin requires us to achieve some sort of closure.
Right.
And so the mistaken direction and tendency of philosophy is to believe that we can somehow close the openness of that origin, mm-hmm. or the impossibility leading to a never closing off of the relationship to the origin,
mm-hmm.
that we can somehow finally resolve that trauma, that tragedy,
right.
that mourning.
Right.
And overcome through philosophy the condition, the human condition, the condition of mortality.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I believe that Plato is trying to argue precisely the opposite in this dialogue, namely that philosophy's relationship to the loss of Socrates.
Mm-hmm.
And Socrates is trying to say in the face of his own death,
yeah.
It's precisely this openness to to mortality, to the human condition,
mm-hmm.
And the impossibility of closure,
right.
that is what philosophy.
So, I mean, you go in the paper, you make an appeal to a kind of notion of health and the notion of the pharmakon, and is it a question of a healthy? I'm a little resistant to use that term, but I mean, Socrates uses it, of a healthy relationship to this openness, a healthy relationship to the elusiveness of the origin, or the, and now elusiveness is probably not the right word, because you're really thematizing it in terms of memory, in terms of past, and elusive might be pushing it toward, you know, impending. But then
they're both present,
right?
in such an interesting way,
right,
I think,
in the dialogue. Know,
so this recollection, which is an extraordinary aspect of the problem memory, but also being towards death,
right?
If I could put it in those terms.
Sure.
And the impending character of that always to come relationship to death, which is a relationship to the future,
right?
And that's so the impossible recollection is precisely then a relationship to an impossible origin or a past that's beyond before time.
In talking about recollection, are there two dimensions there that need to be teased out? One is some sort of access that may be a felt access or a dimly recalled access to the origin, but always an inadequate one. Or, I mean, what is the difference between appealing to talking about philosophy as remembering, which you do in the paper, and I think really in a compelling way, and having thinking about philosophy as guided by a vision of the forms in the sense of an ideal that is pulling us in a kind of direction. I think in the way that death itself probably in the dialogue is pulling Socrates.
Yeah. You know, it's, as you know, that's at the center of the Phaedo are both of those questions, and they are addressed in the context of a discussion of the immortality of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And the first discussion is to think of the immortality of the soul in terms of recollection,
right,
which is in terms of birth and something, and the time before birth,
right,
the time before time, essentially.
Right.
And so it's a dialogue about one's relationship to birth.
Yeah.
And that remains always also a relationship to the openness that one has to one's own origin.
Right.
The uncapturability. There's always some time. There's always the time before. In many of Plato's dialogues, but especially in the Phaedo, we have, for example, I mean, examples of this time before time would be in the Timaeus, you know, where we have a lost origin that is even before the origin of the city.
Right.
And in so many of the other dialogues.
Yeah.
So this time before time is one aspect of the discussion of immortality, but the other side of it, and I know your question is about how to relate these.
Well, yeah. But
the other side of this is also the question of whether the soul will survive beyond death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so will there be a future? Is there a future that beyond the end, so to speak,
right,
you know, and therefore a future beyond time, or beyond the future, and what does that structure that tries to think of an open future, that future that does, that displaces the end by virtue of thinking beyond the future, how does that impact the notion of the human being as mortal, as living?
Right,
and I think it's all together on both sides, if you will.
Right.
It's precisely the relationship of this utter openness in beginning and end, and the establishment of that utter openness that allows us to live.
Yeah,
and so philosophy's relationship to death and to a future to come holds open and keeps us from shutting down. This is a very existential way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
It keeps us from shutting down, from becoming entangled in the everydayness, if you will, from becoming the kinds of bodies who are not free in relationship to the extraordinariness of life, the awesome possibilities of life, and the openness that human life grants us and privileges us with.
Right. So, one of the things I really like about what you do in the paper is that you give a reading that undermines a sort of traditional notion that what Socrates is doing in the dialogue is minimizing the body and embodiment, sort of fleeing from this life and degrading it, right, as a prison. I mean, there's a lot of vocabulary, obviously, in the Pythagorean sort of atmosphere of the entire discussion,
so,
right?
Sure, yeah,
so that's all at play.
All that notion of purification,
right.
Contamination,
exactly.
And health and illness.
Yeah, exactly. So I love the way that you try to show, okay, look, really, you know, when we talk about philosophy as preparing to die, it's actually, it is a reaffirmation of life in a way that is easy to miss when you read and emphasize all those passages that have the body as the prison and all those places where Socrates wants to call our attention to our entanglement with the everyday, and to use the language you were just using. But I wonder what I really want to think about is there, when you talk about memory and the being toward the origin with regard to birth, with regard to recollection, mm-hmm. with regard to what I would call, you know, following, you know, Arendt and Sherman and others, natality, mm-hmm. and versus the other direction of the openness, which is the being toward death, what are the dynamics of talking about remembering that are different from the language of talking about futurity and being towards death? I mean, what are you gaining? Or are you gaining something? Is there something fundamentally different about talking about this in terms of memory and recollection?
Yeah. That's a very hard question. I tried to do some work on that, what's the impact of this double openness? And this picture of the human condition is caught as between mm-hmm. two opposites, origin and end,
right.
which both of which circle back to each other in a certain sense, and so I want to talk about that if I could. This kind of because this dynamic in the dialogue that I actually think the dialogue is all about, which is the holding together of opposites,
mm-hmm.
and one opposite is origin and end, another is life and death,
right.
birth and death, mm-hmm. and so forth. But
mm-hmm.
but it's all about how to think of the human condition in terms of its relationship to opposites.
Right.
It's condition of oppositionality, if I could put it that
sure.
way. You know.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tried to think about that in the end is that there's a certain sense in which this philosophical relationship to origin and end in both cases places us in circulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it keeps open and therefore mm-hmm. keeps the circulation of life from shutting down in various ways. And
mm-hmm.
it can shut down in two ways. It can shut down to a kind of false Platonism,
mm-hmm.
achieving the closure at the limit, you know,
right.
and therefore a kind of reification of life,
mm-hmm.
that we've now solidified a hold on the limit and closed off that limit, and all of that, I think, in the whole discussion of how the care of dying is.
And that's in part, it also relates, I think, to the question of writing, in the sense of a danger of writing is that reified dimension is held up.
Yes.
And the dynamic, the living dynamic of speech is lost.
Yes.
Right.
On the other hand, that raises the question again about why the dialogue, why Socrates begins to think that maybe I should have held a relationship to writing.
Right.
You know, held a relationship to the logos of loss.
Mm-hmm.
And also, another aspect of the dialogue that I think, this complicated dialogue that I think is so important, is that the kind of writing is significant in the Phaedo. It's
mm-hmm.
the recovery of poetry.
Right.
And that's not unimportant. So it's not record-keeping writing.
Right.
It's not
poetry. Well, you mentioned it. When you mentioned that, I went back to look. And because on the one hand, he says he's sort of putting Aesop's fables into poetry. But then he also writes a hymn to Apollo.
Yes.
So it is poetic writing, but I mean, it's not just sort of transposing the fables that have already been written. There is this creative dimension too that he seems to be. And then why Apollo? I mean,
yes,
you know,
that, right, exactly. Yeah. And then why is this? And I think it's fairly explicit in the dialogue that poetry is to be thought also in terms of mythos.
Yeah.
And
right.
not in the telling of stories,
yeah.
but also mythos in the sense of that which has been displaced by philosophy.
Yeah.
So what is this relationship that Socrates feels he has to bring back into play
mm-hmm.
with mythos? What is the relationship between logos and mythos? I mean, he calls philosophy, amutho legem,
right,
you know,
right.
So in the Phaedo, philosophy recovers its relationship to myth,
mm-hmm.
and to poetry,
mm-hmm.
I think that's extraordinarily important, but I think it recovers it in a way that also has established the difference between
mm-hmm.
the two. So that would require, I'm rambling a little bit here, but it requires the thinking about myth, I think, to
yeah.
some extent. The myth, for me, I would want to place it in the context of the discussion we've had about lost origin.
Right.
Because I think that's what Muthos is the story of, and why Plato, in almost every dialogue, has myth, because
mm-hmm.
the myth establishes that that impossible voice,
mm-hmm.
that lost origin, that irrecuperable origin,
mm-hmm.
that without which philosophy would be both dangerous, and I mean dangerous in the bad sense.
Yeah, right, right.
And so the recovery of that, I think, for the future of philosophy, for the future beyond Socrates,
yeah,
you know, for philosophy's capacity to hold open, life to the other,
mm-hmm.
to something beyond itself, and hold philosophy open to something beyond itself,
yeah.
is a gift to philosophy. So
yeah.
philosophy now establishes its relationship to poetry and to myth, a relationship that doesn't close the difference between the two, that doesn't try to appropriate myth into itself,
right.
but allows myth holds its relationship to its own displacement.
Yeah.
You know, that there's something beyond philosophy that motivates philosophy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, maybe so to press that a little bit further, I mean, Plato's response to this is to write dialogues,
mm-hmm.
right? And to write them, but they're dialogues.
Yes.
And so, you know, it strikes me as vital that the written text that we have, the philosophical text, these founding, these original philosophical texts are these highly poetic, highly dramatic, contextualized texts, writings that attempt in various ways to infuse the writing with a kind of living,
mm-hmm.
right, with the life of the spoken word.
Yes.
And I think so I've been trying to think a lot, because I'm trying to work on the question of what Socratic politics is, and have
mm-hmm.
been thinking. At first, I thought I was going to write a book on, well, Socratic politics, and I'm just going to look at how Socrates performs political activity in the dialogues, and look at some of these dialogues and talk about, you know, just focus on what Socrates does in them.
Mm-hmm.
But I quickly began to, well, not so quickly, maybe it took me a little too much time probably.
I get the point. It's a great
yeah,
idea.
Yeah, and then, but now what I'm realizing is that I have to make a distinction between what I'm calling the topology of Socratic politics, or the place of the logos of Socrates' political activity, which is always in relation to other characters in a dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and what I want to call the topography of Platonic politics, which is the place of the writing and the political side, the political dimension of philosophical writing in this sense. And what I mean is not the kind of politics that we sometimes associate with the Republic and these doctrines, these traditionally Platonic doctrines, but the performance of writing as a political activity in the sense of spurring readers on to live a philosophical life.
Mm-hmm.
And so... But there's something very similar between the relationship that Socrates is having with his dramatic interlocutors and the dynamic that's happening between the written texts
mm-hmm.
as crafted by Plato and the readers.
Yes.
And so so this is the question I want to come back to your project on, is the Platonic response to take up writing in this way. Is it an attempt to hold what you were nicely calling the circulatory dimensions
mm-hmm.
of philosophy, but hold it in a way that allows it to be taken up again and again in each new generation, remembered in a certain kind of way?
Yes. So I think that's right, actually. And I think that the discussion in the Phaedo leads me to say that maybe after the death of Socrates, writing is... there is a certain appropriateness to writing,
yeah,
and also a certain danger to it. So writing is a pharmacon for
right.
philosophy. It's a necessary, it's the logos of,
right.
and,
We're not having a discussion about Socrates. If Plato had, we might have had a discussion about, you know, Xenophon, Socrates, you know, but we're not having this discussion. And this figure of Socrates is not a living articulation of what it means to live a philosophical life without Plato writing. Yeah. And being also a brilliant writer. I mean, that's the other thing.
Right. And so Logos is, I mean, in the dialogue, right?
Yeah.
There is a sense in which Logos is what we do in the face of a certain absence.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think on the surface it's in the face of the absence of Socrates.
Right.
But also Logos in the sense in which, because he says, after all, in the second sailing, what can we do in the meantime? Philosophy is about that in the meantime. It's about life, in other words.
Right.
And it's about the circulation of life and how we act, how we hold ourselves in relationship to that.
Mm-hmm.
And in relationship to the desire for completion that is now motivating the circulation of life.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is Logos.
Right.
So Logos is, in a certain sense, I think, in philosophy, is in a certain sense an activity that occurs in the absent, in a certain relationship to absence.
Yeah.
And I think the writing,
yeah.
I mean, in the way it's posed, is also an attempt to acknowledge that absence.
And I wonder what degree, I mean, when we talk about mytholegging, I mean, there's a dimension of storytelling there's a narrative dimension in which meaning emerges. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I wonder about are all the places where Socrates enjoins those he's talking to give an account of oneself, mm-hmm. give an account of one's life. I mean, he does it in the Apology, he himself does it, he's always doing it. He's always giving an account of himself and putting words to his activities in ways that make them meaningful in the context in which they appear.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's part of what Plato is doing when he is crafting these dialogues.
Mm-hmm.
A way of not only giving an account of Socrates, but also giving an account of his own life.
And I would add to that question, also, I would wonder about what it means to do that well.
Yeah.
Because I think clearly that's what Socratic dialogue is about,
right?
And they're giving an account to each other, telling our stories, and it always has that dimension of the care for the soul,
right?
Therefore, a dimension of the care for the transformation of the other,
right?
And that Logos opens up that possibility. I think also this is a theme that, as you know, I developed in the paper to some extent. It's there's also a transportive element that Logos, speaking of the circulation of life, that in a special way, Logos has the capacity the metaphoric capacity, the metaphora, to allow us to actually be in relationship to each other, that the soul can have this experience of being transported to the other, in relationship to the other, that the openness to alterity, which are...
Yeah, because I was going to... You have this great line about the impossible being together, and I was wondering about... I mean, I think this is this... so maybe you can talk... I mean, if this goes to this point...
Yeah, so sort of heading in that direction.
Yeah.
So I wanted to say there that Logos is the possibility of that impossible being together. And it's impossible, I mean, the drama of the dialogue is the absence of Socrates. And so how can we continue to do philosophy in the face of that absence? So the impossibility of Logos, right? Or the impossibility of being together.
Right.
And Logos is the space of that possible impossibility.
Right.
And then on a dramatic level, that's all too evident. And then the question would be why and how to do it well.
Right.
And how to understand the possibility of being in relationship to alterity, to the other, also in relationship to what is utterly other,
right.
It's in opposition, so to speak. Yeah.
But I mean, then that goes back to this original question I was trying to press a little bit, which is the relationship between the loss of this person, this Socrates, and the which is different. Maybe the difference is, or maybe it's not that different. It's this felt loss. It's this determinate, concrete lost loved one. I mean, mm-hmm. it's the difference between losing a parent and thinking, you know, in sort of general terms about, you know, human finitude. But when you talk about generally about human finitude and talk about our relationship to the origin and the end, well, it feels like, okay, that's all very philosophical. When you talk about the death of this Socrates, it has another dimension, but maybe that part of the point is that when you talk about it on the grand philosophical scale, it has the same dimensions as that interhuman mm-hmm. loss.
Yes, okay. So, projecting the dialogue to the next day, mm-hmm. after Socrates is actually gone, now what do we do?
Right.
Because the dialogue is a lot about making us aware of the fact that mourning belongs to the conversation of life.
Right.
And that you're missing that. If you're missing that, you missed something about being with me.
Right.
And maybe this recognition of the impossibility of touching the other,
mm-hmm.
that already has always belonged to our philosophical conversation and
right.
to our capacity to be in touch with the other in a non-appropriative way, if I could put
right.
it that way. You know, it's not, you're all worried about whether you can continue to own and possess me. Yeah.
Well, that's what's so great about the touching in the dialogue, the touching of the hair that Socrates,
it's
you
such
know,
a playful dialogue.
Exactly, and caring. You know, it's this, you know, what is he touches Cebes' hair or Simmias' hair? Or no, it's a, it's, well, anyway, yeah. he, I think it's, maybe, anyway, he, maybe it's Phaedo's hair. Anyway, he has this moment of caring
right.
touch.
Yes.
And it's not appropriative in this point,
yeah.
right? It's a kind of touching that is not grasping, yeah. is not possessing.
So I mean, as you know, a lot of what I was trying to do was to talk about that holding apart, that being apart, the
yeah.
notion of relationality that doesn't think that the solution is in closing the difference
right.
and in somehow achieving some sort of fusion of opposites
mm-hmm.
so that now we can somehow be together.
Mm-hmm.
But to understand that genuine togetherness is a partness.
Right.
And I think that's a lot of the message of the Phaedo is
right.
about, you know, that we should be thinking about a partness, the soul apart from the body and life apart from death, because that apartness is the key to understanding the understanding what life is about, generation,
mm-hmm.
and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I try to think a lot about that in my reading of the Phaedo, a lot about thinking of opposition and of why Socrates insists upon the need to think of the soul apart from the body.
Right.
And even if in the end that's couched in certain mythical terms as an impossible it can't be thought because logos is most for the most part thinking about the coming moving back and forth within life, not
mm-hmm.
thinking about radical alterity as an aspect of
right.
in other words this way in which the mixture the philosophy thinks too often about the mixture
mm-hmm.
and but the more important conversation might be the utter apartness that can't be mixed together, an absolute
mm-hmm.
opposition, in other words, an opposition of contradiction,
mm-hmm.
Rather than the mixture of opposites that occurs on the level of contraries.
Mm-hmm.
And that thinking of the Parmenidean opposition, if I could put it
yeah.
that way, of the holding apart and not thinking them together, I think the message of the Phaedo is that that's precisely what is required of us if we want to understand genuine relationality,
mm-hmm.
In a relationality that's not appropriative,
right.
not the mixture that fuses together opposites.
So in that context, the whole discussion of mythology and misanthropy in the dialogue, I think, comes into some focus because the danger of the opposition of the holding opposites as opposites, or of this lack of interconnection that's always possible. This, the constant failure of the logos to give you what you think, what you thought you wanted, which were these closed answers and this sort of, okay, we know what's going to happen after death, or we try, you know, however many times we're going to try to prove the immortality of the soul, we just keep failing. But don't become haters of the logos.
Yes.
Because if you do, you're not going to try to give an account. It's the trying to give an account and the relationships that we have in doing that that are critical, I think.
Yes, exactly right. I think so. And I guess one, I think, less powerful way of putting that is that failure belongs to the character of philosophical logos.
Right.
Sounds like a...
Well, then, I mean...
A silly thing to say, but there's some way...
But here you do, and you do it in the paper, too, in terms of remembering and forgetting.
Yes.
So there is, in this attempt to remember, in this attempt to give life to Socrates in writing, there's a dimension of forgetting all that's there all the time. And actually, I think Plato does a great job of gesturing to that forgetting.
Yeah.
In the writing itself, first of all, as you point out, by situating dialogues as performances of remembrance by various characters, whether it be, you know, in the symposium when it's all got like five or six layers of remembering, and then checking with Socrates, and then not, you know,
right.
And then, you know, him not objecting, but you're just constantly reminded that this is a tenuous logos.
Yes,
you know,
exactly, yeah.
And it's saturated with forgetting, but also with the possibility of remembering.
Yeah. So to the question of health here that we started out a long time ago talking about, there's a certain sense in which I think that the dialogue tells us that health, or the healthy human being, or the healthy soul, is the one in recovery.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's not a matter of, well, now I've recovered. I've recovered from my forgetfulness.
Right.
I've captured... the memory. It's the uncapturability. But the movement of recovery that is the true character of the healthy person.
Yeah. But I wonder, so put positively, it's the question of flourishing, right? So, I mean, there is a dynamic, and then maybe this gets back to this dynamic of what's at stake when we speak the vocabulary of remembrance.
Mm-hmm.
Versus the language of, and I think the forms that Socrates hypothesizes about function often in this futural way as these things toward which one is directed.
Great, I really like that. That's really helpful.
So then if you have that, then there's something to be gained about this holding these up. And and you do a nice, you mention at the end about the myth and the fish that is going above the water, right?
Yes, right.
You know, and this is that erotic dimension. But
yes.
Then there, so, well, let's, maybe we could do it through, talk about it through with Eros. I mean, is Eros only that futural, or is it this, I guess there's, well, the story is about an erotic relationship to this past, to this person, and this loss.
It is that, but it's also, you're right, so there I was going in the direction of recovery, and you brought up the direction of flourishing, which I do think is about the excitement of what is to come.
Right.
And I think that's the other side of the dialogue. It's very much present in the dialogue.
We
put the emphasis of the dialogue on recovery, but Socrates is a very, very key moment in the dialogue, emphasizing precisely that openness to an unclosed future,
right.
That flourishing, that
you
wonder.
You guys have to keep doing this.
And wonder in the face of philosophy, that not mythology, but wonder in the face of what is and the possibility of what is.
Exactly.
And I think that that's key to that discussion that we had of the relationship between poetry and philosophy, because in what we said earlier, it's about what recovering a relationship to poetry does for philosophy.
Right.
In keeping it open to the other and so forth. But it's also about what philosophy contributes to poetry.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And I think in that case, it allows poetry not to be mere rhetoric.
Right.
because, as you say, the fish out of water.
Right.
You know, the holding open of right. the possibility of the beyond is what gives the intensification to the poetic voice.
Yeah. Well, what I also find so remarkable about the way we've, even in our this discussion here, have hit upon these things. Just think about natality, mortality, remembrance, and sort of vision of ideals of just the good, mm-hmm. recovery, which has this recognition of sickness, versus flourishing, which even though it's oriented toward, but flourishing, if it's futural, it's oriented toward this ultimate death, right? So there's this very strange. I mean, actually, your vocabulary of circulation is probably the best vocabulary, because first of all, because it has the biological notion
yes.
of you know, right. we have to keep the blood flowing, but these oppositions are related in ways that bring them into contact without allowing them to settle. Right.
So, I mean, there's a sense in which that the way I'm thinking about that circulation, if we could do it in terms of a relationship to the lost origin,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we'd almost have to say that there is no origin.
Uh-huh.
So that displacement, but the relationship to the possibility of recovering
right.
is what's important. In other words, it's the circulation that the parting.
Yeah.
It's not so much to get back beyond before,
right. and
this philosophy can somehow put us back before time,
right.
you know. It's not that, it's the imparting.
But do you see that as functioning I have an easier time thinking about an erotic relationship to these ideals that help one pull oneself out of entanglement in mm-hmm. and imagine a new possible future.
Right. That's
versus an erotic. I mean, it's also still a kind of what you're describing with regard to the origin is a kind of erotic relationship to the origin, which remains always elusive. It has to have that. It has to have that dimension of elusiveness.
Yes.
If it's going to be really erotic.
Yeah.
Right.
It's almost at the threshold of the coming into being, or it's the imparting
right.
that's important, and not something that imparts.
Right.
And that's why it's circulation.
Right.
You know, and I do think it's appropriate to think about that as the possibility of love, of
mm-hmm.
eros,
mm-hmm.
And we could go to other dialogues. For that,
right.
Of course,
right.
But,
for sure.
But I think that's a great way to think about it, and that relationship to a beginning,
uh-huh.
to generation,
mm-hmm.
Is extremely important to any erotic possibility that life offers.
Right.
You shut down that, you're not an erotic person.
Right, you know? Right. So. And it does, I mean, I think the thing that I'm just continue to be puzzled by is maybe it's the same sort of function that hypothetically positing an ideal is that hypothetical action is similar to the positing of an origin that is unrecoverable, or even the talking about recollection, because what you're actually, I think, what one is saying is that there's an access to this. That which remains necessarily elusive, but still has the capacity to animate us in a certain way.
Yes, that's a really good, difficult challenge.
Yeah.
Because it does sound like then it could just be a hypothetical imperative that we
right.
That we,
yeah, I don't mean it
that
way.
We make up in order
right.
to foster a creative openness to the future.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
And especially if I want to say that it's an irrecuperable future,
right.
an always to come,
right.
and therefore never achievable,
right.
then it sounds like, well, therefore there's no future. You know?
Right.
So
right.
That I think is
the nature of the hypothesis and what it means to hypothesize. I mean, I guess I worry. Maybe this is the sort of worry from sort of our education with Reiner Schurmann, where we're worried about the positing and what positing involves, and because I don't want to say this is just the positing of an ideal versus and a positing of an origin and then a relationship to that. It has to be, if it's going to function in the way that you have articulated it, it has to be, to use Heideggerian language, having been thrown into a context in which into which we are oriented toward the toward the origin and toward the end in a very particular kind of way.
And so I don't want that to be the case, but I don't feel as though I have an absolutely great answer to it not being hypothetical. But why I don't want it to be is clear to me, because the whole point of the discussion is to hold out the possibility of a relationship to the withdrawn other. I mean, I think this withdrawal of the future. It's not just the absence of a future, but the absence is, by virtue, is a kind of movement of withdrawal. That's why we're calling it circulation.
Right.
But it is it's the genuinely the other who's always a part.
Right.
And if I'm making the other a part.
Right.
I've closed off that possibility of exposure, so to speak. And similarly, I think with the origin, there's a certain sense in which we're not just positing a lost city.
Right.
It's not that we're just making it up because, you know, it destabilizes or displaces in some way the real truth, which is that this institution is all we have and something
right,
like that.
Right, you know? Right, right, right.
But it's a relationship to, I think, a certain withdrawal that allows that institutionalized city, which is in a sense all there is, but to allows that to be in relationship to the ideal city, and always allows it to be in the human way the perfect city, because it's always displacing and keeping open its own limitations.
It's tenuous. It requires active engagement constantly. And it has, including the active resistance to the desire to reify it and make it static, which is a kind of tendency.
This is another, it's like silly thought in a way, but if circulation makes you think of a circle, and there's a certain way in which I think that what we're talking about here is philosophy at the threshold, you know, that because it's not just that, we're not just within the limit of beginning and end,
right?
You know, but we're thinking from the position. This is what philosophy does: thinks from the position of the threshold, and therefore of the exposure to the other, that is impossible in a way, impossible to within, within the circle, if you will, within the circulation, impossible to bring in,
right?
And that's precisely why it's other, you know? But it's extraordinary.
And yet there's access to it. And yes, it's not so other that we have no access.
The access is not to bring it in, precisely not, but to hold it, to acknowledge it in its apartness.
Right, you know? Exactly. Well, Walter, this has been a really great conversation. I appreciate you coming on the Digital Dialogue. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much. It was wonderful.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.